opinion to the clouds into the cosmos. We are pumping wattage high and low, screaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It almost sounds like Christmas time around here. Micah bringing us back in with, what is that, the Messiah, Micah? Well, maybe that's fitting.
I don't know, man. Maybe so. It's fitting at least for as long as we can try and, you know, well, make do with whatever somebody left us here. All of our stuff's gone. I'm having to rebuild our system here.
Oh, all right. Well, hey, you know, it is classic music for a classic man who is joining us tonight, of course. And welcome back to your favorite hub here Saturday nights on News Radio 570 WWNC plus AM 1400. Speaking of strange, and yes, as you know, of course, we have been looking forward to this show because there is a man who has really revolutionized the field of studying the afterlife, and not only that, but also concepts of psychology and philosophy and science that can maybe redefine how we approach a variety of mysteries in the future. He is, of course, the famous author of books like Life After Life, in which he really brought the near-death experience to the awareness of the mainstream public, or his book Reunions, Visionary Encounters with Departed Loved Ones. And maybe tonight, if he wants to, he can even tell us a bit about his newest manuscript, which is currently in the process of being published and printed. But his website is lifeafterlife.com. I'm proud to call him a friend. Dr. Raymond Moody, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you so much, Josh. It's great being on with you again. I really appreciate your having me on your program.
Well, it is a true honor, and I think if I were going to come back from a break playing the Hallelujah chorus for anybody, it would be you. So I am glad that happened, and I hope that folks who are listening will also go to lifeafterlife.com and learn more about you and your research. But, you know, last time you were on, Raymond, we only had an hour, and we covered a lot of the near-death experience work that you've talked about a million times now since writing Life After Life. And tonight I'm hoping that we can get into some of your research and what you're presenting regarding redefining the approach to discussing the concept of the afterlife. But first off, let's kind of focus on the psychomantium, because we got together earlier this year and you gave me and many of my colleagues a wonderful, unforgettable weekend experience telling us about how to properly use the psychomantium technique. So let's start right at the beginning. For people who have never even heard the word psychomantium, what is it and how did you rediscover this concept?
Well, Josh, you know, some of the strangest things in history are demonstrably true and verified, but they are so strange and so sensational that even if you wrote a story about these things to the National Enquirer, it would be rejected as being too sensational that they really happened.
Yeah.
And this particular thing, the psychomantium, has to do with my interest in ancient Greek philosophy. You know, I am a psychiatrist and went to medical school, but before that I got a PhD in philosophy and I was a philosophy professor. And one of my favorite areas of philosophy from the very beginning has been the ancient Greeks. And you know, the ancient Greek philosophers set the whole tenor of Western civilization, everything. They created the logic that we use as we're thinking right now and reasoning together. We're using a logic that was created by these ancient Greeks, and they got everything started. Well, the story of how these people originated is, as I said, it's demonstrably true. You can read it in the history books, but it's just basically unbelievable. But to start, I think maybe many people remember that Socrates was executed, at least according to him, because people believed that he dealt with things up in the air and down under the earth. And that was what the average Greek of that period of time believed that a philosopher was. And what that had to do with was that the ancient Greeks had these institutions called psychomantions, or oracles of the dead. And this is written about in the historians and the geographers of ancient Greece and so on. But the story is so bizarre, and that is that there were these places which you could go, and apparently they would take you through some sort of procedure during which you would seem to see and have an actual visitation with a loved one who had passed away. Well, this, you know, this just sounds beyond bizarre. And generally speaking, when a lot of people read these things in the ancient text, then they just assume it's legendary or hoaxes or whatever. But back in the mid-70s, one of the most famous of these oracles of the dead, the one that's mentioned in Homer's Odyssey and that Herodotus wrote about, and Aristophanes, the comic playwright, made fun of. It's in the far northwest corner of Greece in the province, or the county, in effect, of Thesprotia on the river Acheron. And in the mid-70s, just by trusting what Homer said and Herodotus said, a Greek classical archaeologist went up there and he excavated this place. He found it and excavated it, and what he found was a huge underground institution. It looks kind of like a hospital and kind of like a theater and kind of like a hotel almost, down under the ground, and big dormitory rooms where people slept while they stayed down there in complete darkness. And according to the best sources that we have, that you, when you went there, you stayed down in this underground facility for 29 days. Well, all the stories tell us that what happened in that place was that you actually got to see and converse with your relatives who had died. But for classical scholars for a long time dismissed that this could possibly have happened, because we didn't have any way of understanding how they might have done it. Well, what Dr. Dockeris found in his excavation, when they got into the central apparition hallway, which was about 50 feet long by, say, about 15, I suppose, feet wide at the widest place, they found this long underground chamber where people would actually see the visions of their departed loved one. And in that room, they found this enormous bronze cauldron surrounded by a banister, which indicated that when people saw the deceased, they were looking in the direction of this cauldron. Now, when the archaeologists found this, they thought, well, this is just fraud. They assumed that after having people down there for 29 days, these technicians who ran the place would be able to figure out pretty much what this person was like that the person had come to see, and would hide in the cauldron and act out the role of the spirit. But when I read that, I thought two things. Number one, these people were the founders of rationality, the Greeks. Plus, this institution, this Oracle of the Dead, was in operation at least for 1,000 years, probably longer, but we can document it that it was in continuous operation for 1,000 years. And I felt that absolutely that people would not be fooled by something like that for so long. But more importantly, because of my interest in altered states of consciousness and psychiatry, I knew a plausible alternative explanation for that. And that would be that they would highly polish the inside of that bronze cauldron, fill it up with water and a layer of olive oil. And under those circumstances, when people gaze into what's called an optical clear depth, and it would be like that under the ground because it would be indirectly lit by these torches they had in this room. I surmised that by gazing into there, they really would have visions. A matter of fact, this is still practiced today in the Middle East. People from Lebanon, for example, have told me that they'll take a silver bowl and highly polish it. Then they fill it with water and a layer of olive oil, and they get in a darkened room by candlelight, and by gazing into the reflective surface of the olive oil under those circumstances, many people see amazing full-color, three-dimensional visions, which really don't. It's not like that your mind, you feel that your mind is making them up like a daydream. They seem to act of their own accord. Well, I had done for several years, I had done some work with the mirror gazing and the crystal gazing, which is the way of creating these visions. Before I read this detail and of the archaeological report, which Dr. Dockeris had done, and which I read in about 1985, I had to go and brush up on my German again because it was in German, and I gradually labored through this, and I found all this stuff. And I knew, as soon as I heard that detail about the cauldron, I knew that this was how it worked. To make a long story short, in 1990, I set up a research facility way out in the country, a big old house, and I built a room in which there's a mirror at the front of the room, a wall mirror about 4 by 4, 4 feet by 4 feet. And it's put up on the wall, and a chair is placed in front of the mirror, several feet back, and in such a position that when the person sitting in the chair looks upward into the mirror, they do not see their own reflections. That's very important. It's not a matter of reflections, but rather just gazing into a mirror from an angle in which you see no reflections. All you're doing is gazing into a depth. And I surrounded this area of the mirror and the chair with some dark black cloth, which you can get at the fabric store. It's that cloth that photographers used to use, you know, with a hood over their head to cut out the light. And this fabric, for those who might want to build one of these things, is called T-Shot Poplin. That's T-E-E-T, shot, S-H-O-T, poplin, P-O-P-L-I-N.
Okay, Raymond, we have to take a break, so that's a great place to pause because that history was just the perfect way to set up exactly what you're getting into now. For those who are listening who want to build one of these things, when we come back from the break, Raymond will give you more of those details and also will tell you about some experiences that people have had. Raymond has put, gosh, thousands of people, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and I have had some pretty wild experiences lately myself that I'll tell everybody about. Folks, I'm talking with Dr. Raymond Moody, the famous author and researcher. He is the guy who wrote books like Life After Life and Reunions. And by the way, if you are especially interested in the psychomantium technique, buy his book called Reunions, Visionary Encounters with Departed Loved Ones. There is a link to his website at speakingofstrange.com. When we come back, you'll hear more about how to create this type of a setup in your own home. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Speaking of Strange, we'll return. my friends, we spend so much time trying to learn how we can get some sense of interacting with the past, with the deceased, with visions of the departed, and yet thousands of years ago, the Greeks, they figured out something so amazing that it took an expert on their culture to rediscover it and modernize it for us. His name is Dr. Raymond Moody. He is my guest on Speaking of Strange. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren. It's the perfect way to kick off the month of October. And, you know, I read Dr. Moody's book, Reunions, years ago, immediately started doing experiments with a psychomantium and had success. And since meeting him and going through his course last, I think it was March, I have a whole room of my house now that is devoted to the psychomantium, and I can't tell you how many people, and I'd have to sit down and think about it, have come out of that room in tears and have had what they describe as life-altering experiences because that they have seen something in there they weren't planning on seeing. And maybe I'll tell you more about that later, but I will tell you that the setup that I have in my room as a psychomantium is something that I put together, I think, for less than $25. Nonetheless, if you walk into the living room of my house and turn to the left, you will see hanging on the wall one of my most prized possessions. It is one of Dr. Moody's mirrors that he used for many, many years. It has a big black frame that he and his wife painted black, and it is retired now. It is not being used as a psychomantium, but Raymond, I just want to thank you for allowing me to obtain this so that I can always be reminded of how groundbreaking your work is.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Josh. And I got to say, too, that I am really delighted that you are here to give me social support, man, because honestly, to the people who are listening, I would fully understand, folks, if you conclude that I've lost my mind. But really, this is something, as Josh will tell you, that really works. You can test it yourself, and we both, I'm sure, can guarantee you that if you go through the procedures, that you'll be able to find, at least among your friends, plenty of people who will actually be able to do this, and in all likelihood, you'll be able to do it yourself.
Okay, but, so before the break, you were talking about the physical setup, because I know there are people out there taking notes, because I frequently reference you and your work in the psychomantium on the show. So let's continue telling people how to create this and what to expect.
Yes, to sort of recap, you get a nice wall mirror. The one I use is about 4x4. You need a 4x4 feet. You need a fairly large viewing area to see the visions. You put the mirror on the wall in such a position, and the way I've done it, the bottom edge of the mirror is about 3 feet off the floor. And a chair, which I've my friend of mine took the legs off the chair so that it sits comfortably down to the floor, and the back of the chair leans slightly backwards so that the person sitting in the chair can get very relaxed. If you do this at home, you might want to use even a recliner so that you can adjust the altitude of your back. And behind the chair or the recliner, I put a small light bulb, one of these small things like about the size of a ping pong ball will do just fine, and put the lamp behind the chair so that when you turn the lamp on, you do not see the reflection of the light in the mirror. That's very important. The person sitting in the chair should be in a position where he or she does not see their own reflection. That's very important. You're not looking for reflections here. You're looking to position the mirror in such a way that you can gaze into it and see an infinite depth, like you're just gazing away into infinity. And to secure this, what you do, you hang a curtain of black material And this material you can get in any fabric store. It's called T-Shot Poplin. T-E-E, Shot, S-H-O-T, Poplin, P-O-P-L-I-N. And you will just learn by trial and error how to create a sort of light-proof environment. You can do this by hanging the cloth around in a way to exclude reflections, so that the person sitting in that chair very comfortably and looking up into the mirror is positioned so that typically what would be reflected behind the mirror would be, for example, on the other, away from the mirror, would be the black cloth. So the person in that tiny area with the light on, and the diffused light coming up from behind, just is gazing away into a depth and not seeing any reflections. You might put a rheostat, R-H-E-O-S-T-A-T, like a dimmer switch, onto the circuit so that you can adjust the bulb for the brightness for your own particular preference. Now, that's all the apparatus you need. But the really important part of this is the preparation. And what I do, when I started doing this in 1990, it was originally volunteers who were my graduate students of psychology. And most of them were older people who were back for their master's degrees or whatever, who had been counselors. But there were also some young students, more or less recently out of college, who were very good graduate students of psychology. And the motivation we had was just curiosity. I had read about this stuff in the ancient Greek reports, and I figured out how they had done it. And so it seemed, you know, reasonable to just try to recreate it.
Sure.
And so my students were very enthusiastic. I asked each one of them to choose some one person who had died, whom they had known and whom they had wanted to see again. And they would come out to my place one at a time, because this is a very personal thing. It's best to, I think, to do it alone on a one-on-one basis with someone. And so basically they would come in the morning, and I would just sit with them much as I would as a psychiatrist if I was doing grief counseling for someone, for example, which is all that really involves is just asking people to remember. I would say things like, tell me about this person who's you have chosen that you want to see again. And the main thing in this situation is just to ask very open-ended questions to get people to talk. So as these subjects would begin to talk about the person they had lost who had died, and this would go on for an hour or two, with me asking questions just to get them to bring up very vividly into their mind and hearts their loved one who had died.
Uh-huh.
And after a period of this, now you can't put a time limit on it. It's a matter of really getting down with people and really getting them to bring up their feelings. And that may take an hour or 2 hours, but whenever it is, and when the people have talked as much as they will, you lead them into this little room and you tell them to sit down and on the chair and to gaze up into the optical depth of the mirror in this darkened room with the little light behind them. And you tell them you're going to leave them in there for an hour or an hour and a half. Incidentally, I always sit right outside of this little room in case people want to get up or whatever. I mean, I don't leave them alone. I'm sitting right outside. And then after an hour and a half, I'll go in and I'll get them. I always tell them. I say, now, if anything is going on when I come in here, just signal me away, because sometimes they're in the midst of a vision or whatever. So then after that time has elapsed, I go get them and I bring them out and into my interviewing area, and I just interview them with respect to any experiences they've had. Now, in terms of what will happen to people under those circumstances, I have found, and I suspect Josh has found similar figures that in my work, about half of the people that I take through this procedure will have some sort of experience during this time, which they regard as being a contact with the with a loved one who has died.
All right, time for another break here, Raymond. But when we come back, let's go ahead and get into some of those experiences that people have when they come out of this. And mind you, folks, the way that Raymond is presenting this is from his perspective as a psychiatrist who studied this and an expert in Greek philosophy who was presenting this to people who were working with him as students. You, however, can also take this and do it for yourself. And I actually did a conference a few years ago at the Grove Park Inn, and I was going to set up a psychomantium there and just let anybody go in there and spend some time. And the Ryan Research Center said, no, this is irresponsible. People can go into this situation and have a psychotic break with reality. Well, rest assured, I've talked to Raymond, and he's told me that he doesn't see any reason that should happen under ordinary and normal circumstances. So when we come back, you'll learn more about what does happen to most people. But I'm telling you, if you're the type of person who would just like to have some communication with what appears to be, and that word appears is important, what appears to be a vision of, a dead loved one or something similar, then this is one of the most organic ways you can do so and experiment with this. What a show. When we come back, you'll learn more about exactly what happens to most people when they come out of the psychomantium. And later, we're going to talk to Dr. Moody about his latest ideas on the direction we need to take if we want to make more progress in the field of understanding the concept of an afterlife. His website, by the way, is called lifeafterlife.com. And I don't know, we'll ask him when we get back if he is still available to do courses, weekend courses, like the one that he gave me and my colleagues and friends in March of this year. But if he is, then I would contact him and ask him about that, because I guarantee you it's worth it. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Speaking of strange, we'll be back after this. About mere scrying here. We're talking about something, simple yet more complex, more distinct, more focused, more planned on a particular mindset. And that's what you can set up, actually, an environment in your own home that allows you to, in a very organic and ancient way, to maybe peer into the face and even interact with someone who is long gone, or at least from a different era. It's called the psychomantium technique, and we're talking about it with the man who, at very least, rediscovered it, Dr. Raymond Moody. And he is the author of Life After Life, as well as Reunions. And before we get into some of these effects that people describe and experience when they come out of the psychomantium, Dr. Moody, I know that your schedule is very limited in terms of your ability to get out and do speaking engagements, but are you still open to doing courses for people who have an interest in this? Oh, Micah, do we know what happened to Dr. Moody? Let's get him back.
I actually thought he was still on there. Yeah, we're working on that. Hang on.
Okay, well, that's okay, because I can tell you right now about an experience that I recently had with the psychomantium that we even discussed on this show briefly. There was a young woman who came over to my house, and she was a friend of Mobius's. She had never heard of the psychomantium and knew absolutely nothing about it. So we almost told her about the psychomantium, and then I decided, hey, wait a second, let's do an interesting experiment. Let's not tell this young lady anything about it. Just send her in there, turn on a little white noise and have her, you know, stare at this mirror and just see what happens. Well, she came out, I'm thinking maybe 30 minutes later. She came walking into my living room, and she was in tears. She actually said that she had no expectation about what was going to happen in this environment, and yet her grandmother appeared before her and actually emerged from the mirror, came over, and said, I love you, and some other closing things that needed to be said, gave her a kiss, and then disappeared. And I'm telling you, we don't know for certain if these are things that are simply generated by the human brain or if this is something that in some cases could actually be documented if there were a video camera there. But I believe we have Dr. Moody back with us. Are you there, Raymond?
Yes, I'm sorry, Josh. I don't know what happened. Suddenly.
There was no telling. A couple things I want to ask you before we pick up with what you were saying before. Number one, well, I was talking about a young lady who came over to my house and went into the psychomantium and came out, and as she described, having a fully three-dimensional interactive experience with her dead grandmother. I mean, it was very emotional. Have you ever heard of a case like that or know of a case like that when there was a video camera present that actually captured something, or are we talking about something that so far we can only define in terms of the human perception?
Well, Josh, I have had hundreds of cases like the ones you described where people say that, yes, it says they actually seem to see the apparition of their loved ones emerge from the mirror and come out into the room full color in three dimensions. Often there's conversations. They even say that they hear the audible voice of the deceased. And other people say that they feel that their consciousness goes into the mirror. They go through the mirror and see the deceased on the other side. And this vivid sense of presence people have, in other words, people do interpret this to be a real event. And as to whether you might see anything on a video, you know, I don't know. I number one, I can't even operate my VCR, Josh. So I have never really tried it that way, because I assume from the beginning that consciousness, human consciousness, is needed at least as an intermediary to create this experience. If somebody did set up a video,
now, I've done that, by the way, and I've never captured anything so far. So,
You know what I would bet, and I would bet you would agree with me that this would probably happen, if somebody did it and maybe did it 50 to 100 times,
right,
most of them would probably be, as you described, just just blank. But I think there would probably be a few that would show some wild pattern or whatever, and some people looking at that pattern would say, why, that's Grandma just as sure as shooting, you know, I'd recognize that nose anywhere or whatever. And other people looking at the same video would say, no, that's just a static on the screen. You know what I mean?
Well, I tell you one thing. You may recall this. One of the weirdest things that I've ever seen was at the course that you taught here in Western North Carolina earlier this year, Mark Nesbitt attended. And, of course, Mark Nesbitt is famous for his investigations of ghosts on Civil War battlefields, especially Gettysburg. He actually ran a tape recorder or a digital recorder during his session and played it back later, and there were some of the creepiest growling sounds I've ever heard. He even came on this show and played that tape for us. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. And, again, like I said, since I'm, you know, my last phonograph had a crank on the side.
Okay.
And so what I'm saying here is really I'm just not, you know, competent to, in terms of electronic things to be able to make any assessments. But I wouldn't be surprised, you know. As you sort of indicated with the young woman that you were describing, this sort of thing has a very, very powerful effect on people. People say that they really do, when they see the visions of their deceased, that it gives them some sort of help on their grieving process. It's not, you know, a lot of people go into this and they're sort of imagining that it's something that will be more ethereal and kind of vague. And so what people are really startled by, and I think probably from the way you were describing that young woman, that she had a similar experience, that this is an incredible reality. I mean, it certainly seems real when it's going on, and the subjects are in a full state of waking awareness, but they really do seem to see and converse with their departed relatives.
Well, there's no doubt about that, and we have to take another break. When we come back, though, I want to ask you a question that I posed to you in person, but a lot of people ask me this all the time, even though you have not tried to use some technical means to document what's happening because you're looking at this as a psychiatrist. I'd like to also see if you've ever had a situation in which the information that someone gained from the experience in the psychomantium seemed to come from some place that they shouldn't have been able to access, some form of verification, if you will. And of course, the human mind and the human brain, it's so mysterious that we could also say, well, this person is gaining information via some psychic sense. But we'll dig into that as well, and then of course we'll be up on our hourly break, and then we have a whole other hour with Dr. Raymond Moody. And ladies and gentlemen, his website is called lifeafterlife.com. There is a link at speakingofstrange.com. When we come back, we'll get his answer to whether or not he has ever been able to get that kind of verification, and then more about what the heck is happening to people when they go through this, and that is the big mystery. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Stay with us. We'll be right back. only a few minutes left before we're up on the hourly break. I'm Joshua P. Warren talking with Dr. Raymond Moody. And in these few minutes, Raymond, I'm so happy, by the way, we have another hour. But let me just ask you, I know that as a psychiatrist, your goal has always been to simply focus more on what the subject experiences. But have you ever known of a case in which someone comes out of the psychomantium and has information that person should not have, and you've been able to verify it later to almost give those people who are looking at this as a true portal to the other side some evidence?
Well, there have been cases like that, absolutely. And one of the cases done by a lady who learned how to do this from me, she in March of a certain year, let's say it was 93 or 94, she had a young woman come to her who wanted to see her father who had died a couple of years before. And so the young woman went into the room and she saw her father coming down from above, and he stepped out of the mirror and had a long conversation with her. Then he told us, then the woman came out and she told the woman who had put her through the procedure that her father had told her that in a year she was going to have a child, a baby. And this was startling to her because she had been told by physicians she would not be able to have a baby. So the therapist, the person who put her through this, began to make other interpretations. In other words, you know, maybe a birth can mean a lot of things, right? Maybe it has something that's maybe some other symbolic thing. But to make a long story short, 3 months later, this woman did get pregnant and did, 9 months after that, deliver this baby safely. There have been other things like that, but, you know, I mean, even in those situations, Josh, as you and I both know, it's hard to make inferences. We can always say, well, you know, it might have been coincidence, it could have been all kinds of other things, but yes, that does happen sometimes, that the apparitions that people see tell them information that later on checks out. It does.
It'd be interesting for us to do an experiment taking somebody who is able to consistently go into the psychomantium and connect with a particular apparitional vision and see if, say, let's say I have somebody who goes into my psychomantium at my house, and you have some type of a drawing or something that we're keeping sealed up at your house, and see if they're able to get that information. That would be like sort of, you can almost say it's an ESP experiment, but still, if the psychomantium can be used as a tool to gain information, then it has its own value in that way.
Yes, now there is one way in which absolutely it helps people gain information, and that is that it's a great tool. For example, when you're problem solving or trying to come up with some new idea, Thomas Edison used this in a similar process to get his inventions, and it's perfectly possible to use the same method for figuring out problems. If you're working on a problem you can't solve, early in the day, you formulate it to yourself and make the resolution that evening when you go into your booth, your room, you're going to see visions that would be related to that. And I've used that quite often in my own process of problem solving, and it definitely is very helpful.
And we got about 30 seconds till our break here, but if somebody contacts you and wants to do a course like the one that you gave us earlier this year, are you open to doing that still?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I love to do this. This is I love to teach this to therapists and psychologists or anybody who's interested, because I kind of had to laugh when the people told you at Duke or whatever, the psychical research people, that this is something that you know, you shouldn't be fooling around with that. I mean, that's just frankly ridiculous. I mean, you know, human beings have been gazing into mirrors for many, many thousands of years, and they're in every home. Everybody looks into mirrors several times a day. If there was any danger to gazing into a mirror, I think we'd know it by now. And this process is not something that can be taken over by experts. It is part of the collective cultural heritage of humankind that goes back in every society and every culture.
Okay, well said, Raymond. And when we come back, we'll get into hour two, folks. So we'll talk a little bit more about the psychomantium and then the latest on what we can do in this field. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange.